I'm Marie Bernard, host of Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Join me Mondays at noon as we explore the universal energy that connects us all. Let's discuss our journey of self-discovery, joy, presence, and living with authenticity. We can create positive change in the world, and it starts within each one of us. Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Mondays at noon on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver. Hello and welcome to Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and this is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, or you might be listening at 93.1 CFIS in Prince George, or 92.5 CBFX in Kamloops, or online at CITR.ca, CosmicDimensions.com, EmpowerRadio.com, or on the Co-Creator Network. And today's guest is Mark C. Brown. He is the author of Live Like a Window, Work Like a Mirror, Enlightenment and the Practice of Eternity Consciousness. And welcome to the show, Mark. Hello.
Hello. Thank you very much. I'm really happy to be here.
Thank you. So you have the background, you're a psychologist?
I am a psychologist, been practicing for about 40 years.
But this book, Live Like a Window, Work Like a Mirror, is more spiritual than psychological, correct?
It didn't come out of my practice or what I know from psychology at all. It really is much more than what you described.
Mm-hmm. And so what inspired you to write this book?
The inspiration actually is, inspiration itself is a good word, because that is exactly what happened. I didn't have writing a book in mind. In fact, writing this particular book is not something I would have been able to do, except one Sunday morning in, a couple of years ago in July, I went out on the porch with a cup of coffee and a legal pad, and I started writing the information that just came as sort of a download to me. And I spent the next 2 weeks of mornings filling four legal pads with the content and title of this book. And so the information in the book, the writing is mine. The information in the book really came to me. So it's like a spiritual download. So the book really is an inspired work in a pure sense.
And so, Mark, now you talk in the book about enlightenment as a birthright. Tell us more about that.
All of evolution in this book, the purpose of evolution, creation and evolution of where we are now, is what is referred to as enlightened awareness. Everything has evolved to the point of the highest, farthest, most evolved physical structure, which is the human brain. And then with the brain's capacity for imagination and abstract thinking, the ability to step away from ourselves and look back at ourselves as if we're sort of witnessing us as we live our lives. And that awareness, that self-awareness, is the threshold of enlightenment. Everybody has this capacity to be self-aware. Once we become really clear that it's there, we can practice in a way that allows us to become very, very skilled at watching everything that comes up in us, all our feelings and thoughts, and our emotional reactions to things that go on around us, and then to do something that we don't ordinarily do with them. And that's also in the book, and that's what Living Like a Window and Working Like a Mirror is about.
So this
enlightenment part is really the outcome of all of evolution, and therefore something that is everybody's birthright.
So let's talk, Mark, about what it means to live like a window, work like a mirror. What do you mean when you say that?
Well, imagine a window if you just imagine a square window with a couple of hinges on one side and a latch on the other, with the window closed and the glass in place, color and light can get through. But if you open that window so that it's just an open space, potentially anything can pass through. That's a prescription for living an enlightened life, in that with the practice of meditation, with taking time to be quiet and still and watching what comes up in us, what we can do instead of reacting in our normal ways is allow all of those feelings, the worries, the concerns to pass through, just as if they're passing through an open window. So that, if you think about it, this open space that anything can just flow through rather than sticking to us. You can imagine the serenity involved in that. working like a mirror, you imagine holding a mirror out in front of you so that anybody looking at you would really see his or her own reflection. What that does is it allows people to be just who they are, to see themselves just as they are, rather than as we wish them to be, so that we're not projecting anything onto that person. We're just accepting that person just as that person is. Same with world events. Everything that goes on outside of us is reflected in the mirror. It sort of reflects itself. So in essence, what we're doing is allowing people and events to be just as they are, not as we might wish them to be.
Interesting. Because when I think of a mirror and reflecting back to someone, my interpretation of that is that it would be more reactive. Because
yes,
you are reacting to them rather than just being present.
Yeah, in this case, you're literally a looking glass, and you're not reacting. That person is just being who he or she is, just as they are. That doesn't mean you don't have interactions, because you certainly do. Otherwise, you wouldn't have relationships. But what it means is that you, as far as possible, you just are allowing that person to be who he or she is. You're not commenting or judging or criticizing or having needs of that person. You're not trying to change that person's style. You're just really allowing that person to be who he or she is. And same with world events. So if something happens in China or in New York that really doesn't impact me here and now, I can leave that alone. I can allow it to just reflect itself. So the idea in this is not to have input, not to interject self, myself, into either the relationships by way of needs, my dependency, my feelings, or into, world events in terms of the way I would prefer things to be, and instead just allowing them to be as they are as much as possible.
Okay, so now this all sounds great in theory. We would all, we're so many of us, I'm sure that everyone who's listening to this show right now has at least the level of self-awareness that they're able to notice their thoughts that come up, notice their snap judgments and reactions and things like that. But being aware of that is just the first step. How do you, you can have the intention of being all zen and not reacting to people, but how do you actually do that in practice and stay mindful enough to be consistent?
Probably a lot of people don't have that level of awareness. I imagine your listeners and you and I do have that level of awareness where we're looking at ourselves and we're actually desirous of getting to know our personal styles better and to probably be more peaceful in that regard. It is absolutely doable. The thing about it is, though, that it takes work. We have to be, this awareness is a huge, huge first step, and the desire to be different is also extremely important. And then it's a matter of practicing in a meditative way every day, just calming ourselves and calming ourselves and calming ourselves. And in the book, I talk about doing that, and I'll talk about doing that on this show, too, so that whenever you can, and we're going to be imperfect about it for sure, whenever you can, when something comes up, rather than reacting to it, you take a breath and you let it slide. And that applies to what goes on inside, and it applies to how we would normally react to other people and to circumstances. So the prescription, live like a window, work like a mirror, along with the practice of becoming quiet and still really, really works. And over a period of time, people are going to see that they get better and better and better at this. It really is our destiny to do that. That's why we have this ability to be self-aware and to calm ourselves in the first place, because we have this ability to capitalize on that and become truly peaceful people.
So do you have...
It's more than an ideal. It's something that's very, very practical.
So do you have any specific? I mean, you mentioned meditation. Do you have any other tricks that something, okay, so your spouse or your boss just says something like really inflammatory and your gut, you feel your heart pounding and you get all flush and you can feel that you're just about to blurt something out that is a reaction, a fair reaction to what they're saying, but we don't want to do that. So how do you stop yourself? How do you catch yourself before that our hardwired instinctive response comes out? How do you stop yourself in that moment?
Well, the hardwired response is the fight-flight response, and that comes on automatically when we feel a sense of threat, and we're either going to back away from the threat or we're going to take somebody on. It depends on the circumstances. It probably also depends on a person's nature. Some people are fighters and more other people would rather back away. So what we want to do is practice downshifting our brain wave dominance from the fight-flight dominance, which is typically up in the beta range, down into the meditative ranges, alpha and theta. And we can do that with our breath work. So if what we do is constantly practice diaphragmatic breathing, it's called belly breathing, where when you inhale, the expansion is down in your belly rather than up in your lungs, higher in your lungs. What that does is it really can keep you from getting into the fight-flight dominance. And if that's the case, then you won't have the reaction you might normally have. And let's say that rather than reacting 100% the way you used to react, you react 80% that way, and then 70%, and then 60%. And maybe you only get down to 40% of what you used to do. That's a huge change, and that's what we're looking for. The other thing is, as much as possible, you know, we don't want to be around people who act like that if we can avoid it, because they'll constantly disturb our peace. And I think people who are on a peaceful path get to a place where they have to make changes, because if they're around people like that, whether it's at home or at work, because it's just too disruptive.
But then have you ever had the experience of someone, either you have a problem with someone and they're constantly treating you like crap, and then you talk to other people about them and they're like, wow, I've never had that experience? Or the opposite, where someone is always complaining about this person, but the person in question has always been kind and wonderful to you. I mean, if we're all mirrors for each other, if you're surrounded by a bunch of douchey people, isn't that a reflection of yourself?
Well, you won't be, I don't know that you'll go anywhere where you'll be with a bunch of peaceful people. Because the way I think about human nature is on a continuum, and I place a bell curve on that lets us know where most people are going to fall, right in the middle, and where people are going to fall, on what percentage of people will fall on either end. And to find truly peaceful people, you know, you're really talking about a relatively small percentage. So, you know, for the most part, we're going to be dealing with people who are more average or more normal. And I think as much as possible, you look for peaceful circumstances. But otherwise, if you can't change the circumstances, then you really have to not react to them the way you might ordinarily react. And to whatever extent we can calm ourselves, to whatever extent, whatever percentage we're able to tone things down, to that extent we're going to be more peaceful. Sometimes it causes folks around us to be more peaceful too. You know, they react to the environment, to the vibrational rate. But other times it's not going to change them at all. But our job will be to work on changing ourselves. And you can be more and more and more peaceful than ever over a period of time working at it than before. And it's absolutely worthwhile. There's a real reward in that.
So how peaceful would you say you are on a just overall daily basis?
Really, I'm really peaceful. And even more so, actually, since writing this book, because I have a better understanding of what I'm here to do and how I've evolved to this place. And I've always meditated, but now I can do that in association with living like a window and working like a mirror, and those things really, really work. So, you know, and I get increasingly peaceful. I'm not ready to head off to a Buddhist monastery yet, I don't think. But, yeah, I think more and more peaceful over the years, no question about it, with practice.
Wonderful. Well, it is time to take a break. We'll be back with more synchronicity in a moment. Right now, we are speaking with Mark C. Brown. He is the author of Live Like a Window, Work Like a Mirror, Enlightenment and the Practice of Eternity Consciousness. And if you want to get in touch with him, markcbrown.com is his website. So this is Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and we'll be back momentarily.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts downtown at
212 Productions, Beat Street Records, Blim, Dream Apparel, The Fall Tattooing, The Kiss Store, Heart and Soul Clothing Inc., Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinema Tech, Project Space, Scratch Records, Vinyl Records, Woo Vintage, The Zoo Shop, and across the bridge, North Vancouver Music Gallery.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
This year, the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation of Canada and Abbott Canada are launching a new scholarship program in support of inflammatory bowel disease, IBD, and student care. The organizations will extend 7 one-time scholarships of up to $5,000 Canadian to students living with IBD who are entering into or currently attending a post-secondary educational institution. For more information and eligibility, please visit ccfc.ca.
Welcome back to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I am your host, Marie Bernard. Thank you for being with me today. I just want to send out some sparkles and some love because I'm kind of feeling that way today. And yeah, I went to this clothing swap the other day at the Museum of Vancouver, where the planetarium is. And I was so excited to go mainly because at the planetarium there's this little pool and with a fountain, and the ducks live there. That's where they have their babies every spring, and so you get to see little baby duckies. And so I was super excited, but they had actually emptied out the pool when I went, so I didn't get to see any baby duckies. So I hope that you get to see some baby duckies this spring because they're so cute and fluffy. Anyway, back to the conversation at hand. We are speaking today with Mark C. Brown. He is the author of Live Like a Window, Work Like a Mirror. Welcome back to the show, Mark.
Thank you. And there is nothing cuter than little baby ducks.
I know. I saw them a few weeks ago when they were just little freshies, you know, like super fluffy and tiny. So I imagine they're probably kind of teenage duckies right now in that awkward phase.
Remember a couple years ago, a mama duck led all of her babies across a pretty busy road, and we all stopped and watched them cross. It was just the neatest thing.
Aww. I love springtime and seeing all the little baby animals. I haven't seen any. I never see any baby squirrels. I don't know what happens to them. Maybe they hide in trees until they're big enough to come out.
Well, they're harder. I live in a woods, and we have lots of squirrels, and it's harder to tell than they're just really a little bit smaller than the adults. I think they do wait a while to come out.
Hmm.
So they're probably there, but not so easy to tell.
And baby bunnies.
Oh, boy.
They're really cute. They're so tiny. There's some, I was out in White Rock a couple of weeks ago, and I don't know what kind of rabbits they are, but they're like jackrabbits or something. They go so fast, and they have strong hind legs. And, you know, they'll sit there really quietly, but if you get too close, they'll just bolt so quickly.
Oh, yeah. Oh, they are gorgeous.
Anyway, so I love to take a moment to appreciate the cute little springtime animals. So I'm curious now, in your book, Live Like a Window, Work Like a Mirror, you talk about there's some sections. There's cycling, materiality, the self, and the ego. Can we go over those and
oh, sure.
Explain cycling, please?
Well, cycling is one of the really basic movements of creation. Cycling is, we see it in our lives every day, but one of the most common ways is in just the thoughts that go through our head over and over again, stuff that sometimes we think is just ridiculous or useless, but it comes back through over and over again. Somebody estimated that like 90% of what we think today, we thought yesterday. So there's that, but there's also, there are things like anniversaries and birthdays and solstice celebrations and harvest rituals and things like that, that are these annual cyclical events. And what they reflect is the cycling in the universe on a larger scale. For example, the rotation of the Earth on its axis and the orbiting of the Earth around the sun, which really allows life to occur on the Earth. So we have these small cycles and we have these grand cycles, and that goes all the way back to the moment of creation. Cycling is what allowed this creational burst of energy of the basic elements of creation to keep from just, if you think about an explosion, it kept these elements from just flying out into space forever. What cycling did is it pulled on these elements and allowed them to sort of fold back in on themselves the way breakers do coming to shore. And what this did, this enfolding action did, this really started the material universe, because then things had a chance to coalesce into bits of matter and then from there evolve into more and more complex forms. So cycling from the very beginning has been a basic movement, a basic component of creation and evolution, without which there wouldn't be any time or space continuum, and there certainly wouldn't be this evolved life that we experience now. In the book, cycling is talked about in creational terms, but then in the end, when we're talking about becoming more peaceful, we're able to look at things as they cycle through our minds over and over again. And that allows us to identify these things that we can then go to work on and begin to calm down. You know, typical reactions, for example, or, well, especially those things we've, you know, maybe been doing for years and years and years. Because we are able to step back from ourselves, we can watch the cycling that goes on in our minds the same as we can watch other cycles occur in nature. And that gives us the advantage of then being able to calm down our reactions to those cycles, which then they themselves will begin to slow down. We'll have, we may never get rid of a certain thought, but we can certainly not be as disturbed by it or not have it come around as frequently as it did before.
So, Mark, now it's interesting that you said, just, I mean, this is just an estimation, of course, there's no way to really measure it that accurately, but 90% of the thoughts we thought are thinking today are the same thoughts we thought yesterday and last week. So this process of change is a slow one, because even when you're aware, we are stuck in this cycle. We have these hardwired neurological, like neural pathways. So, I mean, what do you tell people who are just getting started on this path, or even people who have been listening to this show since day one or have been practicing meditation for 15 years and they're really not that much farther ahead? They maybe are judging themselves and thinking, gosh, I should be enlightened by now. I should not be so reactive. My life, I should really have my crap together at this point. Why am I still thinking, you know, maybe 75% of the same kind of thoughts I was thinking a decade ago?
Well, one of the, I think what's very helpful is to think about what Buddha said. Somebody asked Buddha, you know, how long does it take to become enlightened? And he said, as long as it would take a bird trailing a scarf over a mountain to wear that mountain down. And, you know, so what he's saying, he's not giving, obviously, an exact amount of time, but what he's saying is that this is a very slow process. If we think about cycling as the beginning of the universe and as then a basic component of evolution, and think about things in evolutionary terms, we're talking about, you know, a time frame of billions of years. Now, we don't want to take billions of years to improve, but it's not going to be a fast process. Buddha said that, and he's really the person we think about most when we think about enlightenment. The idea of enlightenment is that we become lighter, that we lighten up, that our consciousness, our spirit, isn't weighed down as much by the drama of normal everyday life than it was before. So what we're trying to do is we're really trying to just sort of take that scarf and, you know, I think of it as a silk scarf against a granite mountain. And, you know, if you think about it that way, the progress is really, really slow. Two things. One is we have to be very, very patient about it because it's going to take a long time. And the other thing is we want to be persistent. So this idea that we're trying to improve incrementally should be encouraging if we experience any change at all over time. So if I'm less reactive today than I was 5 years ago, and I'll know circumstances where that's true, to me that's quite an accomplishment. I think the other thing Buddha would advise us to do is if we start feeling impatient, to back off and give things even more time so that we're not putting ourselves under the gun. I have to make this change in this amount of time or I'm not being successful. I practice psychology. I do EEG biofeedback, and I see lots of people who come in because they're having panic attacks. They have these patterns of very severe anxiety. So for them, you know, the suffering's pretty intense. And what we'll accomplish over a period of months, especially using meditative techniques, EEG biofeedback, is to get them not only not to have the anxiety, but to be more peaceful than they ever imagined. And usually they then continue this practice. They were motivated to do it in the first place because they were suffering, but then they're motivated to do it because they see the benefits in it to them personally and become more and more and more peaceful over time. So to people who are kicking themselves because they don't think they're doing so well, I might suggest they try to find somebody who teaches meditation with EEG biofeedback because that can really speed the process up. But I would have them just really stay with it, pay attention to their reactivity to what goes on inside of them and to things that go on around them all the time. It has to be the most important thing they do. They're always paying attention to their breathing, to calming themselves, and to their reaction to things, working constantly to react less and less and be more and more peaceful from within.
So thank you, Mark. And I'm curious about the EEG biofeedback. I did some brain state training with a guy, Brain State Tech is his company. And is that the same thing where, like, they would look, they put these little electrodes on my head and then they and then they put headphones on and I heard these, like, noises and beeps and music. Is that the same thing?
Well, it may be that. We don't, I don't use headphones, but what you would do in my office is you sit in a comfortable chair with your feet up. You'd have a couple of electrodes on your head that would be, they would be collecting the electrical impulses that your brain puts out. And in order to, you'd be watching a video video screen and your brain would be making a kind of video game go. And the way it would make that go is by monitoring its own functioning by way of the feedback it's getting from the computer and then making changes incrementally in the way it generates power in different brainwave frequencies. And the learning is from this feedback loop, the brain and the computer, where the brain's getting feedback about how it's performing, and then it's changing the way it functions in order to make the video game go. The advantage of that is that it's real learning that's going on. You're getting actual feedback that you don't get when you're sitting meditating by yourself. So it sounds to me like that probably is what you were doing. Were you watching something while you were doing that?
It was, I think, about a two-week process. So there were some things where I would just watch a video of, like, with, you know, the ocean or whatever. And other times there were little games like that where I had to, like, raise the bar with my mind and things like that.
Yeah, the Alpha Theta training, it's called, is the meditation training. Alpha is the brainwave frequency we typically get into when we're just really relaxed, but you know, still really tuned in. Theta is frequency a little below that, and just below that, and just above sleep. And what EEG biofeedback does with alpha theta training is, with your eyes closed, gives you a tone, two tones actually, to tell you when your brain's producing alpha and theta. So what you're doing is being rewarded. Your brain is being rewarded for actually blocking out other functions and just concentrating on those two frequencies. And therefore, since you're being rewarded for those frequencies and your brain is being told right when it produces activity in those two frequencies, then you really learn a lot faster. It's really focused. So if you were sitting with eyes closed listening to tones or an ocean sound along with tones that told your brain that it was producing an alpha and theta, with my equipment, you would get a bong kind of sound, of like a Tibetan bowl sound for theta, and you would get a chime kind of sound for alpha. And that then tells your brain precisely when it's in that range, and your brain then remembers that. It says, oh, this is what I'm supposed to be doing now. And then when you sit on your own, and all the time, your brain is much more familiar with getting into those brainwave frequencies.
So, Mark, if we're looking for a psychologist who does the EEG biofeedback, how do you recommend people inquire about that or find out where it's available?
Well, I belong to an organization called EEG Spectrum International, and there's a website, eegspectrum.com. And anybody who's affiliated with this organization has lots of training in EEG biofeedback. So they're going to be people who know what they're doing and can be very helpful. There are other organizations. The biofeedback certification, BCI, I think it is, Institute. Probably, I don't know if they have a list, but they may. I think what I do is go online and just Google EEG biofeedback and see what comes up. And, you know, if you can get a reference from somebody, that would be really, really good.
So I'm curious, do you ever do this to yourself? I just imagine you sitting there with these electrodes on your head playing Pong with your brain. Do you do stuff like that?
Yeah. The games are, they're not that kind of video game. They're not that quality video game. I have in the past. I don't so much anymore. Now I, you know, I do my work and then I go home. And I sit in the morning. Usually I have headphones on listening to some really nice music and I just pay attention to breathing. I don't do it on myself so much anymore, but I have. It used to be the alpha theta, the meditative one, used to be my favorite one to do. And there are people who practice EEG biofeedback who do a lot of it on themselves. I know that's the case. Really, it's remarkable stuff. It's very, very effective. And, you know, you had talked about our hard wiring before. And the thing about the brain is that there are certainly things hardwired in that, you know, you aren't going to be messed with, such as, you know, regulation of heart rate. And I guess some Indian yogis might be able to affect that somewhat. But a lot of things are supposed to be automatic. But there are things like memory traces that cause certain continuing reactions to things that may be unconscious that you actually can change with EEG biofeedback, for example, because you're working directly with the brain to change the way it functions. And brains typically are conservative by nature, and they also operate pretty automatically. So if you've developed a certain pattern of reacting, then your brain's going to continue to do that automatically, even if it's uncomfortable. You would think that a brain would change its ways if it was doing something that was unhealthy, but that's not true. I think anybody who's tried to kick an addiction, smoking, eating, anything else, will tell you that their brains do not cooperate. Brains actually try to get you to do just what you've been doing, even if it's unhealthy for you. So what we have to do is work with our brains to get them to pay attention to what they're doing and reward them for doing something different. And brains are really designed to operate efficiently. They just need feedback to let them know when they're operating inefficiently, and they'll begin to make changes. Meditation can do that all by itself because you're working to get your brain to calm itself, and when you do that, you're able to watch what comes up, and then you practice not reacting in the usual way. So then you're really working very directly with the wiring there. With the EEG biofeedback, your brain is really hooked right in with a computer, so you get to do that very, very directly. It's just a much more efficient process.
So, Mark, I'm curious. A thought came up about our hardwiring in our brain and how it takes so much time and practice to really change those neural pathways. But when something happens, we have a big trauma, that tends to pretty much instantaneously hardwire these reactions into our brain. So I'm wondering if there's a way that we could do kind of the opposite of that with like almost a positive trauma, like something that is so big that it instantly creates these happier neural pathways in our brain rather than the traumatic ones.
You know, as far as I understand it, and I think this is correct, it's the yucky ones that tend to stick better than the happy ones. So, you know, the ones that are threatening to survival, whether it's an actual threat or a perceived threat, you know, where we, and for some reason, we exaggerate things, or whether it's a real threat or an imagined threat, those tend to have more of an impact, and probably because of their threat, they are a threat to survival. So the first thing our brain's going to do is try to prevent us from getting into danger by warning us off. What happens with time is if bad things don't continue to happen, usually the good things or good enough things sort of surround that, the way maybe, you know, if you get a splinter that you don't get out altogether, you get more and more layers of skin over it, and it becomes less and less of a bother. You might not even notice it over time, but it's still there. And what you said about some trauma, new trauma, setting that off is exactly right. You can have many years of doing very, very well, not reacting to certain stimulation the way you used to. But if it gets severe enough, what our brains will do is they'll go back to that original place where that was really burned in there to remind us of that danger. So what we want to do as much as possible is practice having a different reaction to that stimulus so that it becomes less and less and less intrusive in our lives. I think it may be like a scar, you know, a physical scar you have that may fade over time, but it may not go away altogether. Or, the you know, a break in a bone. Actually, bones sometimes, I guess, heal so they're stronger at that break than they were initially. But if you look at an x-ray, you can tell that break had happened. So, you know, there's always that possibility of touching on the original sore and having a reaction. But, you know, the more we practice, the less reactive we're going to be, regardless of what it is. And even if we get back to one of those really, really difficult places, if we react to that differently, 5%, 10%, that's a gain. And over time, that will continue to happen. We'll get better and better at not being as reactive, even if we don't get rid of it altogether. So, you know, we're looking at becoming relatively more peaceful or relatively enlightened in the sense of not being bogged down by the drama of everyday life.
So what do you suggest for people who have been on this path and they're going along and they're doing far better than they ever were? They're noticing that, you know, they're not having the same reactions. They're taking a moment when someone's does something that's upsetting, rather than reacting right away, they're taking a moment to pause before they have a reaction. And so they're overall, they're doing quite well. And then, like you mentioned, something big happens again that triggers it, and everything comes flooding back, and they're almost maybe not at square one again because they have learned all of these skills and all of these techniques. But emotionally, it's almost like, well, what have I been doing for the past 10, 20 years? Why am I back here feeling like I was when I was, when this bad thing happened? What kind of advice do you have for people who've been so deeply triggered again that they're right back where they started?
I think the thing that came to mind is, if something like that is really troublesome, it might really be good to go and talk to somebody about that. And I would continue the practice, but I would also maybe want to talk about that, because maybe expressing it openly, once it's really come back to awareness, will help to get some of that stuff out that's still there, that is like that splinter's there. Help try to get that splinter out so that place isn't so powerfully disruptive anymore. Usually, if people have been practicing, not avoiding the circumstances, but practicing so that either that circumstance or something similar to it, obviously to them, has improved. Even when they go back to that original reaction, it won't be as intense, or if it does happen, it won't, the intensity or the reaction won't endure as long, and certainly it doesn't happen as frequently. And those are the three criteria I use when I think about real change. People don't change all of a sudden. The image of somebody going to a psychoanalyst and finding that one key that unlocks all this repressed stuff and they're cured is overblown. What typically happens is we react with less intensity. If we react intensely, we react for a shorter period of time before we make a comeback. And over time, that we are less frequently upset in the first place. And if each time this stuff does come up, we continue to practice as much as possible this non-reaction, then the intensity and the duration and the frequency all will continue to improve. But I think if there's really some trauma, you know, I've seen people who were sexually molested as kids who didn't talk to anybody until they talked to me in their 40s. You know, it's like that information was really stuffed away. And when it did come to light, they really needed talk about it in circumstances where they didn't feel overwhelmed. They were with somebody who wanted to listen and be supportive. And then I could teach them how to approach that in a different way, too. So I would say if something comes back and really smacks you really hard and you reel for a long time, I'd go talk to somebody about that.
All right, thank you. So it is time for another break. This is Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and we are speaking with Mark C. Brown today. He is the author of Live Like a Window, Work Like a Mirror, Enlightenment and the Practice of Eternity Consciousness. And this is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. We'll be back with more Synchronicity in a moment.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
My name's Chris Horrific.
You always wanted his character to be bigger than life.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is, without question, the greatest sports and entertainment event of all time. Be a part.
from 1 to 3 p.m.
The Parts Unknown Show on 101.9 CITR. Sometimes cosmoses collide.
Break your fingers.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Welcome back to Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and today we're speaking with Mark C. Brown. He is the author of Live Like a Window, Work Like a Mirror, Enlightenment, and the Practice of Eternity Consciousness. And if you want to get in touch with him, go to his website, markcbrown.com. Welcome back to the show, Mark.
Thank you.
So let's talk about, we just have a few minutes left in the show. Parts Unknown is coming up in about 14 minutes here on CITR. So I'd like to talk a bit about eternity consciousness. Or is there anything else that you think is super important that I haven't asked you about?
Well, eternity consciousness is a term that this book introduces. I've not seen it anywhere. What it refers to is our sense of our connection with all other living things and all inorganic things, everything in creation, and then tracing that all the way back to our roots, the roots of everything, which is eternity. Prior to creation, all there was this completely empty, limitless, unchanging, perfectly serene condition that we think of as eternity. That is the place out of which everything came, and it came out of it, and, you know, there have been different stories about how it happened, but in essence, it's really a mystery. The point is, though, that is our place of origin, and it's the continuing backdrop to everything in creation, and that perfect serenity that's there is something that we can tap into. That's what the practice of living like a window and working like a mirror is about. That's what taking time to be quiet and still in meditation are about, is getting into that quiet space that's available to us when we get into our uncluttered, really peaceful, essential mind. So eternity consciousness is allowing that perfect serenity, that sense of unchanging, limitless, perfectly serenity to filter into our lives now, so that it sort of gives us such a perspective on things that stuff that bothers us will bother us less. It's, you know, it puts some of our worries and concerns into proper perspective when you think about where we come from and that essential eternal kind of serenity surrounding us. Other things in the book, I think the thing I'd want to emphasize is this idea that we are capable of being aware of ourselves as if we are both acting on a stage in a play and sitting out in the audience watching ourselves as we act in that play. We have this ability to watch us live our lives as we actually are living our lives. That's the high end of all of evolution, billions of years of evolution, the whole physical substrate, and then the mental world coming from that, what we think of as the spiritual world, all of that has come to this place of heightened awareness on our part. What we want to do with that is recognize what a gift it is, and capitalize on it by developing a daily practice where we just really, really pay attention. Buddha said our greatest gift is our ability to pay attention. And I think he's was exactly right about that. If we do, the payoff is going to be that we're going to be able to tap that unchanging, perfectly serene, eternal realm in the here and now and be more peaceful than we ever imagined.
Beautifully said. Thank you so much. And so I'm just curious, what is the biggest thing that you're hoping to share with the world through your work and through your books?
Well, this book, I've read it 20 times, and I love it. And this information is a download to me, so it was fresh and new, and I just love the concepts that explain creation and existence and the outcome of existence. I think people are going to love to see that too, rather than just having stories that are handed down that sort of, you know, encapsulate things in a relative time frame. This gives a whole fresh perspective on how things started and how things are absolutely connected from the very beginning. Everything is connected to everything else, leading all the way up to our higher consciousness, our higher human consciousness, and this ability to be aware. So one thing I think the book will provide for folks that I think they're going to love is this perspective that just hasn't been available before. And the other thing is the prescription. Living like window, working like a mirror. You know, these are really common everyday images if you think about it. Even though there's some pretty meaty, complex stuff in the book, there are these examples and images that bring it all down to a practical level of usage. If people practice living like a window and working like a mirror, even though it's not easy, especially in the beginning, they're going to be able to be more peaceful than ever before. And just like anxiety feeds on itself, worry feeds on itself, once you really get peaceful, once you see that you can actually cause it to happen, that feeds on itself too. It makes you want to do more and more of it. So at the higher ends of human development, higher ends of awareness, we have this possibility of using our ability to pay attention to help create a kind of serenity that we might not have ever had before. And the information in this book and the prescription for practice to become this more peaceful person is there, and it really, really works.
Thank you, Mark. So is there anything else that you'd like to add before we close the show? It's been such a pleasure speaking with you.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, too. I think I want to encourage folks to stick with their practice. What our brains are going to do is try to keep us doing what we've always done. And that's actually that's ego's role. Ego's role in our lives is to keep us from moving on to this place where we can step away from ourself and watch what's going on and realize that that's not all it's about. What we're really about is getting beyond that to this place of what's in the book called pure observation or autonomous awareness that isn't associated with our worries and concerns in the human drama. We can get to this calm place where we're involved in life, but we're also really watching what's going on without the usual reactivity. That's really doable. And I would encourage people to have a daily practice, perhaps read this book, so that they can experience that. Once they do, I think they're going to be enlightened that this whole business about higher human consciousness is really meant to help us be more serene, more peaceful, happier people. I remember the Dalai Lama said the purpose of life is to be happy, and I didn't know in the past quite what he meant about that. But I think I have a better idea, that is someplace we can really, really get to more often than people probably believe.
Well, thank you, Mark, so much for being on the show. It's been such a pleasure, and have a great week.
Okay, and you too. Thank you very much
for
having me.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So that was Mark C. Brown. He is the author of Live Like a Window, Work Like a Mirror, Enlightenment, and the Practice of Eternity Consciousness. And you can connect with him at his website, markcbrown.com. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and this has been Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. And I want to thank you so much for being with me today. It has been such a pleasure being with you. And I just want to remind you to shine your light bright today. Send out love to the world and have a wonderful day, a wonderful week. I love you so much. I bless you. Thank you. Namaste. And up in just a moment is Parts Unknown with Chris Arific. And I'm going to close this show with a song by Kara Johnstead from her album Paths Cross. Have a great week, and I will see you next time.
In all. SFU Woodwards presents Myth, The Golden Dawn. An original electronic opera, The Golden Dawn will be performed in two intimate shows at the Goldcorp Centre for the Arts. For Myth's live show of elaborate and handmade costumes, visuals and lightings, they have created an electronic opera that weaves a story told in theatre, dance and video. The Myth plays Studio D on June the 22nd and 23rd. Showtime at 8 p.m. Tickets are $20 and can be purchased through sfuwoodwards.ca.
Plunge into the rabbit hole at Electro Swing Club Vancouver's Electro Tea Party on June 15th at the notorious Canvas Lounge in Gastown. Indulge in a world of wonder and mystery. Be as mad as a hatter. This Alice in Wonderland inspired event will be a soiree to remember with Electro Swing, live jazz, burlesque, circus performers, and fire breathers. Advanced tickets are $15 at High Life and Red Cat Records. For more details, check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/electroswing.vancouver or call 778-329-7039.
Spectacular Motion Notion Festival runs July 19th to 23rd near Golden, British Columbia. Headliners include The Crystal Method, Dirty Phonic, Savoy, John 00 Fleming, Gaudy, Fair Noise, Ill Gate, Ace Ventura, Agape, Bug Squad, Kratty, Subvert, Perfect Stranger, Matt the Alien, Samples, Optical, Future Primitive, Long Walk, Short Dog, and many more. For full information, go to motionnotion.com.
Music Waste is Vancouver's premier independent music festival, highlighting our region's most exciting and innovative bands. Come out between June 7th and June 10th to see shows by Apollo Goats, Capital Six, Phoenix Thunderbird, Ketamines, and Weed, as well as art and comedy. Full festival passes are only $15 and promise an unhealthy amount of awesomeness. For more information, visit musicwaste.ca.
The question, what kind of cities do we want to live in? How do we want our cities to be? Cannot be divorced from the question of what kind of people we want to be.
Join me, your host, Andy Longhurst, every Tuesday at 5 p.m. for The City, an hour dedicated to critical discussions of urban issues. On CITR 101.9 FM and streaming live at citr.ca. For more information, visit the show's website at thecityfm.wordpress.com.
Lovely. This is 101.9 CITR and the Parts Unknown show. Oh?
I wanted to be a writer, but I couldn't write a word. I went to school, I went to school. One time I thought I would be a baseball player, but everybody was bigger than me. On the field, on the field, I follow the rules, and I got everything. Then I thought I'd make some money by selling the most important piece of my shoe. It was cool. And by the end you were long gone. I said I was a fighter, but I was a fool. I'm a fool. I follow the rules, and I got everything. I follow the rules, and I got everything. I follow the rules.
That's where the saxophone comes in. I was going through the whole album, and I was told that Mr. V. Wecker himself, Keith Wecker, of the V. Wecker Ensemble and Aquanaut, just a big beast of a lovely man. I know that I heard that he was supposed to have a cameo along with another saxophone friend. I don't know if it was Jesse Taylor of Twin Crystals, not sure. But I went through all the songs of the new album by the Apollo Ghost, Landmark, and there it is. A lot of skrunky goodness at the end of the tune. I followed the rules and I got everything. Doesn't happen for everyone, but for Mr. Teacher, it worked. Now, you can follow what Adrian Teacher has been doing all his life, and you would probably live a life that is full and rich. But I say, go your own waste. It's music waste. Wow, what a horrible segue. This week, one of my favorite weekends, I love Music Waste, and it's happening starting technically tonight with some comedy at the Prop House Cafe, and there's a whole bunch of improv comedy stuff that is littered all through the week in support of Music Waste, but there's also some great bands playing some great music, and I wanted to get to a couple. But I also wanted to get to some other stuff, too. Just there's some new things that are on the on YouTube now that new bands with their new albums have dropped onto new Bandcamp sites. And I wanted to play a couple today. Now, I have been on Bandcamp this morning, and for the very first time in ever, it is going all MySpace on me. I press a button that says play, and it says efforting. Sometimes the length of 2 minutes, and I say screw it. So I am hoping that you will hear the new Needles Pins track, Breadwinner Takes All, from their 1234 album, released on Mammoth Cave Records, the darlings of the front page of Discorder magazine. You might hear that, or you might hear something else by White Lung. They have a new album out called Sorry, and I want to maybe get something on by White Lung. Let's see what you get now on 101.9 CITR.
Yeah.
yes, it's going to be one of those kind of shows. Will it? Let's see. I tried to do the Niels Penn song, and it efforted immensely. I was waiting. I felt like I was waiting forever. Now, if that happens again, I will always have a backup. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Oh, dear God. We are in dark times with Bandcamp, at least today. I hope it's just for today. No matter. There is a fantastic band out of Vancouver, British Columbia, that call themselves Hard Feelings. And my buddy, Rick, formerly of the band Cadeau, came personally to drop off an LP called DRBC. I wanted to play the first track. I played it last week, and it's really great. It's called Ah Snake. I play it for you now on 101.9 CITR. This is the Parts Unknown show.
We'll be right back.
fantastic. So fantastic.
Maybe it's time for romance.
Perhaps my favorite song from the Ketamine's album, the very new one. It's called One Year. Reminds me of a King Kong and the Shrines song, but I can't think of which one that I'm thinking about. Welfare Bread? I don't think it sounds like Welfare Bread. It's a song called One Year. They're from Lethbridge, and they're coming to town in part to perform, I think, Pat's Pub. Don't ever quote me on any date or any venue of which a band is coming. But don't even trust me in the fact that they're coming. But I think that I heard from a friend that the Ketamines from Lethbridge, a great rock and roll act, dynamic frontman and all those good things, and dorky video that somehow kind of fits. It feels good watching it. I feel like I know at least one of those guys, and he's having a good time, and that's good. I'm having a good time, and I hope all of you are as well. All right, so my big enemy right now is that of Bandcamp, but I think that I have been balancing chaos quite well. Do you realize how much I am on pins and needles right now? Ha! Speaking of which, all right, I got the Needles Pin song, but I played a whole bunch of other tunes with Needles Pins. There's a tune that Needles Pins Trio out of Vancouver had on their 1234 album, something about breadwinners. It was lovely. I really like that song. I also played it with Kiss. Oh, I love that song. I remember hearing that at Corey Schiavone's house when I was like 9. I was like, this is the best song ever. And it still kind of is. From Rock and Roll Over, Meet You in the Ladies' Room. Bad Sports so complimented the Kiss song, it's not even funny. They're talking about stuff, and so was Kiss. We go on. I played something from Hard Feelings, and I played some White Lung, and began the whole show with Apollo Ghost. And I think at least two of the bands that I played are, in fact, playing as part of the Music Waste Festival. And there's more to come. There definitely is. Now, I have been efforting very, very hard and long and fast to get you a tune by the Courtneys. They are playing, I believe, the Rio Theater on, not the Rio Theater, Rickshaw Theater. Why did there have to be two bloody theaters in Vancouver that began with an R? That's confusing me. I confuse easily, yes. I believe it's at the Rickshaw Theater, and Paulo Ghosts are also playing with the likes of, I think it's, wait, I can do this. Hermetic? I think Hermetic are playing. Yes, and Cloud Splitter. Very nice. That looks to be a good show. So go to that. But on Friday, this Friday, if you are wasting, you got so much to do, just take a bike and hit every Greater Vancouver little art space if you can, because there's something wonderful happening in each of it, like the Courtneys playing. Now, if you do not hear New Sunday, you will probably hear a Peachy song, and no, the Peachies did not reform to play Music Waste.
Thank you.
Lovely. That's New Sunset. Start New Sunday by the Courtneys. And this band, I had no idea existed until about 2.5 hours ago. They are from Vancouver, and they play some lovely rock and roll. They're playing this Thursday at the Zoo Shop with Inherent Vices. Oh, Burnside, How I Love Thee. Movie Land, oh, every one of those lovely ladies in this band I adore. And Coco, I know a little bit about them, and they seem nice. This is a band that's playing with all those cats. A little band called Bad Channels. The cover of their album has Drunk Skateboarder with a jean jacket that I want so bad. This is a tune called Dripping Pan.